God exists. You know, we're realizing more and more how important it is for us to be prepared with apologetics. And we're thankful for brethren that are credentialed scientists like Dr. Jeff Miller that are able to present a rational view of the natural world and its origin that is in harmony with the Bible. And that's what he's going to be doing, presenting evidence that undergirds a view of the world that is in harmony with creationism. And that's what we'll be discussing tonight, tomorrow, and Sunday. He's a biomechanical engineer, holds a bachelor's of physical science from Fried Hardeman, as well as bachelor's and master's degrees in mechanical engineering from the University of Texas at Arlington, with an emphasis on thermodynamics and biothermoscience, biotransport phenomena, and biomechanics. He also holds an earned PhD in mechanical engineering from Auburn, with emphasis in navigation and control of biological systems. He's presented research in technical science conferences across the country, has published research internationally in peer-reviewed technical science journals, and he's an active and recognized member of the scientific community. First time I heard Jeff speak was at Polishing the Pulpit a few years ago, and he was talking about some of the expeditions that he's gone on. He's participated in 5 creation geologic expeditions in Wyoming, studying seismites and lands formation, dinosaur fossil beds in Tennessee, studying rapid cave formation at the Grand Canyon, studying evidence of the canyon's rapid formation and carving during and after the biblical flood. And I was very interested in that, and I think our young people, too, should be looking forward to maybe doing that themselves, that if they're interested in science, maybe that could be a goal of theirs one day to be involved in something like that. So we're thankful that Dr. Jeff Miller has come our way. We're very eager to hear the evidence that he can present to us and articulate so ably. We're going to have Brother Matthew McBrayer, the preacher at Cerrito Church of Christ, lead us in a prayer real quick, and then we will begin our first session. And so, Matthew, if you want to come here and lead prayer, and then Dr. Jeff Miller will speak to us.
All right, let us pray. Our gracious and loving Heavenly Father, we thank you so much for all the opportunities that you've given us in this life, the material blessings and the things that are just the blessings that you've given us spiritually as well. And Father, we thank you so much for the time that we have to come together tonight to hear a lesson from your word and to think about all the apologetics that we need to understand in order to stand firm in our faith and to be able to bring others to Christ in such a world that is just filled with all sorts of uncertainty. Father, we thank you for Brother Miller coming this way and being able to prepare these lessons for us and to teach us and help us to guide others. It's in Jesus' name we pray. Amen.
Appreciate very much you being here this evening. Appreciate the opportunity to be up this way. I don't suppose I've been to this relative area to speak before, so I appreciate this opportunity. As was mentioned, I've got materials back there on those tables. The far left table are filled with free items. The other two tables are filled with things for purchase. Be sure to check those out this weekend. The material I'll be covering in this first session is basically a summary of this book, FYI. Does God Exist?, which we put out about a year ago and was co-authored by my dad, myself, Kyle Butt, and Eric Lyons. All of us have material in there that we participated in writing that book. Lots of material to cover this weekend, so I'll be trying to move pretty quickly. I made these up earlier this week, and then they printed them, so be sure to have one of these if you're interested in following along and having something to kind of take notes on and help you stay on top of the major points that I'll be discussing in these various sessions. So we spend a lot of time in the church and at Apologetic Express, where I work, countering evolutionary theory. And we have to do that. It's eroding faith in the Bible, and it's doing so in a widespread way. There's a mass exodus from the church going on over that issue. When we look at the statistics of what's happening to our young people as they go off to college. And so we as Christians, we examine the evidence and we spend time countering evolutionary theory. But what about our model? So evolutionists are turning around and pointing the finger at us and saying, you know, you guys spend all this time trying to pick holes in our model, but where's your model? We at least have something, and that's better than what you guys have. We at least have a model, a framework that we can use to explain everything that you see when you look at the universe. Creation can't even claim to be scientific without a legitimate model, they're saying. In 2007, Michael Shermer published a book where he tried to make the case against intelligent design and creation and make the case for evolution. He's a very popular, very famous skeptic, has a monthly column in Scientific American, very influential guy. Here's one of the things that he said in his book. For creationists to disprove evolution, they need to unravel all these independent lines of evidence, which he spends time discussing in his book, in which the other seminar I do deals with those, as well as construct a rival theory that can explain them better than the theory of evolution. They have yet to do so, he says. He said, intelligent design creationists have no science to speak of. If creationists want their doctrines taught in public school science classes, they need first to develop a science and then to convince scientists that their scientific ideas merit inclusion based on the quality of the arguments and evidence. A famous philosopher from the 1800s, Herbert Spencer, he said, those who cavalierly reject the theory of evolution as not adequately supported by facts seem quite to forget that their own theory is supported by no facts at all, Spencer says. So have you ever noticed how when you've only heard one side of the story, a lot of times you may feel convinced that that side is right until you hear the other side? That is what's going on in our colleges with our young people. They've only heard one side of the story. They haven't heard creationists be able to give a counter to these kind of argument. So, you know, we've got lots of materials responding to the first half of Shermer's challenge. And again, I've got a whole seminar on that. But notice what we're going to focus in on during this weekend is the second half of Shermer's challenge. And that is, we need a rival theory that can explain the physical evidence better than evolution can. And according to him, we haven't done that. And so this is a real argument that they're using today against biblical creation. So notice, defeating error is good. That's important. But it doesn't teach the truth. What it does is leave this empty vacuum that has to be filled with something. So how do we know which model is right? How do we know creation is right? Is there scientific evidence that supports specifically biblical creation? Or do we have a blind faith in biblical creation? Do we have a model that can be used as a framework for scientific study to explain everything in the universe when it comes to our scientific observations? So in this heavily scientific day, these are crucial questions, ones that young people especially need answers to. And so we want to spend some time looking at that. The law of rationality in philosophy says one should only draw those conclusions that are warranted by the evidence. And some people would be surprised to find that that is a biblical concept. Examine everything carefully, hold fast to that which is good, or test all things, hold fast what is good. So you need to examine the evidence before you believe something. That's important to God, and it should be important to us, therefore. God does not want us to blindly believe that He exists. He expects you to weigh the evidence and come to the right conclusion from that evidence, to know the truth that will set you free, John 8:32. So biblical faith is not blind. It's not this blind leap, where you're blindfolded or something, you jump off a ladder or a cliff or something, and you hope someone's there at the bottom to catch you. That would be fideism, according to Merriam-Webster Dictionary, reliance on faith rather than reason in pursuit of religious truth. All right, so notice that modern dictionaries pit faith in contrast with reasoning and evidence. Because that's what the bulk of the religious world has come to believe about faith, that they're somehow, they have nothing to do with each other. Biblical faith is actually belief or trust that is based on evidence. We use that term in the same way today, like the faith or trust that you have in a parent or a friend or a spouse that's based on evidence, that's based on proof. A person has proven himself to be trustworthy, worthy of faith, belief, right? Faith, belief, trust are translated interchangeably from the underlying word pistis or pistuo in the verb form. So God has left evidence for us in many forms, and perhaps the most obvious of which would be the evidence that shouts out from the things that God has made. For since the creation of the world, God's invisible attributes are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse. So it's crucial that we have evidence for the creation model. And if we want to win the hearts and minds of people in this scientific age in which we live, we have to be able to fill this void that we leave when we counter evolution. Fill that void with a model that can be shown to harmonize with the scientific evidence. Fill the void with the true model of our origins. Notice, before any other false model fills in the gap. And there are other models out there. Even in our country, we're heavily pluralistic now. And so this is where creation science comes in. The modern creation science movement is working hard to develop rigorous, scientific, thoroughly tested model theories that then go into a model of origins that harmonizes with our scientific observations and Scripture simultaneously, so both reason and revelation. So not only is refuting error the right thing to do, we also have to be ready to teach the truth when that error has been defeated. And so that's the goal of this seminar this weekend, to systematically make the case for the biblical creation model. So if a person is going to try to build the biblical creation model from the ground up in a systematic way to, for example, a naturalist that knows nothing about biblical creation, he's first going to need to prove that a God has to exist, right? There's got to be something outside of the natural realm, something supernatural. And then he's going to have to show that that God is specifically the God of the Bible, as opposed to the millions of other gods out there that people claim exist. And then show that the Bible is specifically that God's word. And then he's going to have to lay out what the Bible claims with regard to the origin of the universe and the scientific history of the earth, especially as it relates to major events that could shape how we perceive the universe, and that'll help us to be able to interpret the physical evidence, our observations. And then he's going to have to show that that model is valid scientifically, that is, it is backed by evidence and can make predictions that can be verified when we then examine the actual evidence. And then finally, he's going to want to show that the creation model is robust, that is, it can withstand scrutiny and criticism, which is ultimately where we as apologists especially are headed, to make sure that we can defend the biblical creation model. So this tower is the goal of our weekend. Now, concerning the existence of the Creator, the first plank on our tower. So in studying the created order over the centuries, humans have reasoned through from the evidence and articulated many excellent philosophical arguments that point to the conclusion that there has to be a God. These are arguments which, fight though the atheist might, continue to stand as testaments for the existence of God. They've never been disproven, and they have stood in some cases for hundreds of years. Blair Scott of American Atheists, he said, concerning these classical arguments for the existence of God, the theological arguments have not changed much over thousands of years. And so he meant that as a jab, as a scoff at theists in his debate when he made this comment. But really, he was right. The classical arguments haven't had to change much over the centuries, because truth doesn't have to change. The only thing that's happened now is we've continued to gather more and more evidence that substantiates these philosophical arguments. Truth does not need to change. In fact, a famous British cosmologist and evolutionist, Fred Hoyle, this is the guy that actually coined the term Big Bang. He said, you should be suspicious of a theory if more and more hypotheses are needed to support it. Now, I think that is ironic. Because that statement perfectly describes evolutionary theories, like the Big Bang and Darwin's general theory of evolution, which are constantly having to be adjusted, in certain cases even being totally revamped, in order to stay in harmony with the latest observations. But the classical arguments for the existence of God have never been disproven. They continue to stand as testaments against atheism. So let's look at several of these. Number one, the moral argument. Humans intuitively know that right and wrong exist, what we call objective moral value, that isn't based on human opinion, what you think, what I think, it's above us. So right and wrong that we all understand is right and wrong for everybody in every location and in every time. Okay, so an objective system of morality, however, that is above humanity, cannot have been made by humanity. So by implication, there would have to be a moral being that humanity, above humanity, that created morality. See, if atheism is true, then there's no such thing as right and wrong that is objectively right and wrong for everybody. Richard Dawkins, in his book, The God Delusion, he said, absolutist moral discrimination is devastatingly undermined by the fact of evolution. See, if evolution is true, then absolute morality, absolute right and wrong, what we call objective moral value, can't exist. In February of 1998, William Provine, who was a professor of evolutionary biology at Cornell, he laid out several of the undeniable implications of the atheistic worldview in a speech that he gave. Notice number three that I highlighted. According to the naturalistic or atheistic evolutionary model, no ultimate foundation for ethics exists. And notice also that he said that Charles Darwin understood that perfectly when he developed modern evolutionary theory. Here's what Darwin said in his autobiography. A man who has no assured and ever-present belief in the existence of a personal God or of a future existence with retribution and reward can have for his rule of life, as far as I can see, only to follow those impulses and instincts which are the strongest or which seem to him the best ones. So according to Darwin, pure naturalism, so atheism, implies that there is no set moral standard. There is no right and wrong. There's just opinions and impulses. French existentialist philosopher Jean-Paul Sartre, he said, everything is indeed permitted if God does not exist. So if there is no God, then there is no higher being that can give absolute law that everyone is subject to. There's just opinions, and there may be people that are stronger than others that can enforce their opinions on others. Now, when you stop and think about this practically, you probably think to yourself, you know, that doesn't seem like that's right. That doesn't seem accurate. I think that bothers our intuition and common sense, which is why not even the leaders of the atheistic community really stick to the implications of this point. A few years ago, a Twitter user made a tweet to Richard Dawkins saying, honestly don't know what I would do if I were pregnant with a kid with Down syndrome. Real ethical dilemma. And Dawkins said back, abort it and try again. It would be immoral to bring it into the world if you have the choice, he said. So, obviously he came under some fire for his comments, and then he defended himself. I do not for one moment apologize for approaching moral philosophic questions in a logical way. There's a place for emotion, and this isn't it. So from his standpoint, why would a person spend time, energy, and resources helping the evolutionary unfit, okay, someone who is a significant drain on society and other humans? So why would you try to keep people around that are loaded with harmful mutations, syndromes, and disorders? See, from a purely naturalistic perspective, to do that would be fighting against progress and evolution. It would be, as Dawkins said, immoral from his standpoint. Well, so the day after the public backlash from his comments, he attempted to calm the anger he had generated by further clarifying his thinking on his website. He said, for what it's worth, my own choice would be to abort the Down fetus, and assuming you want a baby at all, try again. Given a free choice of having an early abortion or deliberately bringing a Down child into the world, I think the moral and sensible choice would be to abort. I personally would go further and say that if your morality is based, as mine is, on a desire to increase the sum of happiness and reduce suffering, The decision to liberally give birth to a down baby when you have the choice to abort it early in the pregnancy might actually be immoral from the point of view of the child's own welfare. In any case, you'd probably be condemning yourself as a mother. You know, what a warped viewpoint, isn't that? Or yourselves as a couple to a lifetime of caring for an adult with the needs of a child. What I was saying simply follows logically from the ordinary pro-choice stance that most of us, I presume, espouse. So if there's no God, then there is no such thing as immoral, right? Even though he's throwing that term out there as though that is objectively the case. He just believes that, but you can't be objective. There can be no such thing as immorality from an atheistic perspective. You know, who's to say who's wrong? But in truth, we all understand there is right and wrong. Even he gets that. We just can't get away from that. Now, we might disagree about what constitutes right and wrong if we fail to turn to the ultimate judge on the matter, but we still know there's right and wrong. That seems to be a mechanism within us. Dan Barker is a pretty notorious atheist and debater. He wrote the book Godless, where Richard Dawkins actually wrote the foreword. He was the co-president of the Freedom From Religion Foundation. Not sure if he still is, but Kyle Butt for Apologetics Press, he debated him in 2009. And during the Q&A portion, he asked Barker if it would be acceptable to rape a girl in order to save humanity from an alien race. And here's what Barker said. It would be horrible. It'd be regrettable. I would hate myself. I'd probably kill myself after doing it. But I would have the courage if that was the only option. If that were the only option, then I would go through with it. I would pity that woman. I'd pity myself. But morality would require me to take the course of action that results in the least amount of harm. Notice, he believes in morality. He's just defined it based on his own feelings. And those of you whose lives that I saved by doing that, you might be disgusted at what I did, but you'd be alive rather than dead. So in that weird situation, which is hypothetical and extreme and would never happen, there are cases where what we think are right and wrong could be flipped around, he says. So Kyle proceeded to ask him, okay, well, wait a minute. Would you rape two women? How about 2,000? Would it be okay to rape 2 million women? Barker said, to save 6 billion? Yes. Yes, it would be, because otherwise you've got 6 billion deaths. Are you telling me we should not do what is, there it is again, morally necessary to do to minimize harm? So notice, atheists can't really help but talk about morals as though they're objective. Everybody should be doing these things. But there can be nothing that is morally necessary if there is no moral law higher than man. Well, it doesn't matter what culture or setting a person grows up in. We all understand from a young age, even if we haven't been taught about it, that there is right and wrong. So we know, for example, that it isn't right, it isn't fair, usually the term that we use as kids, if another kid comes and takes something from us that isn't his, that's ours, that he hasn't been given or hasn't worked for or had. So we don't even have to learn that. We know it. You know, that's not fair, we think. We know, even if we're 3 years old, and if we steal a cookie and our brother does too, but I get in trouble and he doesn't, we know that's not right. It's not just. Okay, so we all understand that it's not fair. For example, if you work your whole life for something and then somebody beats you up and takes it, we know. Nobody has to teach you. That's not right. That's not fair. See, we have within us this fairness meter that we've been created with. Mankind understands this. We understand if we do a bunch of work writing a paper and then someone comes and plagiarizes that, it's not right. Now, we may accept these things and say, oh, well, you know, that's just the way of the world, and move on. But the point is, we all know it's unfair, it's wrong, and it's not an opinion to say that. Injustice is objectively wrong. We understand within us that there's a higher law that governs everybody about fairness and justice. It's above humans, and it's not subject to our opinions. But again, there cannot be objective morality, an objective law code that is above opinions of humanity without there being a lawmaker that wrote that law code. So objective morality illustrates there must be a God, and this is the moral argument. I think it's interesting to note the fact that when you turn to the Bible, the English words that we translate righteous or just are translated interchangeably from their underlying Greek and Hebrew words. In Hebrew, tzaddik can be translated righteous or just. In Greek, it's dikaios. It can be translated, again, righteous or just. And so the implication seems to be that what is right and wrong comes down to, by definition, what is just or fair. So this idea of fairness and justice, that undergirds morality. And we all understand there's such a thing as justice and fairness. Do unto others what you'd have done to you. Why? Because that's fair. All right. So the minute that a person admits that there are things that are objectively unfair for everyone, then he's admitting to the existence of objective moral value, which then admits the existence of a higher being. And therefore, he's rejecting atheism, which is mutually exclusive with objective morality. All right, number two, intuitional argument. Humans are incurably religious. Our intuition tells us there's a God or something we're supposed to be worshiping. It seems to be common sense to humanity, as though we've been programmed to believe. According to adherence.com, some 92% of the world believes that there's something beyond the purely physical. 86% worship something, and the rest arguably worships themselves and each other. Animals don't do this, but humans seem to have been built with a desire to worship something. And atheism can't explain this apparent instinctive tendency of humanity. Famous skeptic, again, Michael Shermer, that I quoted from earlier, we perceive nature to be intelligently designed. Since the most common reason people give for why they believe in God is the good design of the world, intelligent design creationists are tapping into the intuitive understanding most people hold about life and the universe. This is intuitive. Our intuition tells us design is everywhere. Richard Dawkins says, it's almost as if the human brain were specifically designed to find Darwinism hard to believe. He says, why, if it is false, does every culture in the world have religion? True or false, religion is ubiquitous. So where does it come from? So this is the dilemma that they have. Psychologists Paul Bloom and Dina Weisberg of Yale and University of Pennsylvania, respectively, they acknowledged there's by now a large body of research suggesting that humans are natural-born creationists. When we see non-random structure and design, we assume that it was created by an intelligent being. This is what the actual science is showing us, that we're intuitively religious. This religious inclination of humanity is a major problem for evolutionists. Why? Richard Dawkins highlights it. Religion is so wasteful, so extravagant, and Darwinian selection habitually targets and eliminates waste. So why do we have religion? Famous atheistic philosopher Daniel Dennett expounds on this problem of costly religion. The world is populated by billions of people, almost all of whom devote a significant fraction of their time and energy to some sort of religious activity. Rituals such as daily prayer, both public and private, or frequent attendance at ceremonies, but also costly sacrifices. Not working on certain days, no matter what looming crisis needs prompt attention, and abiding by a host of strenuously observed prohibitions and requirements. So if evolution were true, then why wasn't religion eliminated? The animals still don't worship, but humans engage in this costly endeavor that should have worked against us from an evolutionary perspective and ultimately caused the demise of humans, and of course it did not. So evolutionists are going to great lengths to try to explain why humans would be religious. For instance, Richard Dawkins has irrationally proposed the idea, you know, maybe religion is something like a virus that has infected our genes and it's being passed on genetically. Anybody think that's silly? As you might suspect, this argument has serious flaws that we've addressed elsewhere, which again, we actually have a chapter on that in here that Kyle wrote on that subject, Kyle Butt. So bottom line, humanity seems to have been built to be religious, and it makes no sense from an evolutionary perspective. They have no legitimate argument in response to this. Our natural inclination to believe that there's something above us that we are beholden to and should worship is evidence that such a being exists that put that instinct in us. And I think that's what's being alluded to here in Acts 17. And he has made from one blood every nation of men to dwell on all the face of the earth, so that they should seek the Lord and hope that they might grope for him and find him. So he's made us to seek him and with the hope that we'll grope for him and find him. He's put that instinct in us, though he is not far from each one of us, for in him we live and move and have our being. So God made us with this desire to seek him and grope for him. Human intuition indicates that God exists. The aesthetic argument, so the fact that beauty exists and we have been given the capability of appreciating it. So atheism can't adequately explain beauty because that appreciation for beauty, by and large, has no evolutionary advantage. And so this highlights the fact that there's a God who exists that cares for his creation and wishes to give us joy and pleasure. Now, Darwin recognized this argument as a threat to his evolutionary theory. In The Origin of Species, he said this: "Some authors believe that many structures have been created for the sake of beauty to delight man or the creator, or for the sake of mere variety. Such doctrines, if true, would be absolutely fatal to my theory." All right, why? Well, because evolution can't explain how something would become beautiful without a purpose beyond just the sole benefit of others. See, because evolution is survival of the fittest. It's about selfishness. It's the selfish battle of the strong for survival. It's not about others. So evolving a trait has to have a selfish benefit, not purely for the benefit of someone else. So his argument was that, you know, beauty wasn't created. Maybe it just evolved accidentally, and then it stuck around, for example, in the beautiful male birds, because that beauty benefited those creatures personally in getting mates, what we call sexual selection, while the ugly animals didn't get those mates, and so they died out. All right, now there's a problem with that. Number one, there's a lot of ugly animals out there, right? But also, Darwin's natural selection only attempts to try to explain the survival of the fittest, not the arrival of the fittest. So evolution has no answer for how those creatures could have evolved the beauty in the first place. So the accidental creation of beauty that was then appealing to mates. Few people know that there actually is no known evolutionary mechanism for the generation of new genetic information. Mutations don't provide that. But new information would be necessary to create beauty where there once was not beauty. And I talk about that idea of genetics in my book and also in the other seminar. But also number two here, and this is important, notice that natural selection doesn't explain why you have an innate appreciation of beautiful things in the first place. Why do you get joy and pleasure and happiness merely from hearing beautiful music from an orchestra or from seeing a waterfall or a sunset? So natural selection might explain why certain things that are beautiful tend to stick around, but they don't explain why we see that thing as beautiful in the first place. Why do we have an appreciation for beauty? And therein lies the argument for the existence of a loving God. He's made everything beautiful in its time. Ecclesiastes 3:11, things that are pleasant for the eyes. Ecclesiastes 11 and verse 7. The ontological argument, this is a complicated argument to understand, heavy in philosophy. The idea is that you can't conceive of a quality or a characteristic that doesn't exist in some being. So whenever you make up something that you've never actually seen or witnessed in your mind, it is still always comprised of things that you do know exist. So, you know, take a moment, make up a creature in your mind, you know, all right? So a four-headed dragon with snakes for legs, it's got fire coming out of its eye sockets, you know, whatever. All right, so notice that this creature, whatever you come up with, it's composed of things that you have seen and know exist. Heads and snakes and fire and eyes. All right, you can't really come up with anything totally new. Something that is comprised of characteristics that you don't know exist. So you think of all the Star Trek characters, for example. They're all comprised of qualities that you know exist. And so the ontological argument says you cannot conceive of something, characteristics that don't exist in some being. You can, however, conceive of superlative characteristics like omniscience and omnipotence and omnipresence, omnibenevolence, and so forth, indicating that they must exist in some being. Okay, so is this just an imaginary being with these imaginary characteristics? All right, so let's think through that. So if a characteristic were just imagined, you just made it up. Okay, let's say you just made up omniscience. Okay, well, that wouldn't be a superlative degree. It wouldn't be the greatest, because there would always be something even greater. What could be greater than an imagined characteristic? Well, if that characteristic were actually real, not just imagined, it would be greater. So a real characteristic is superlative over an imagined one. You can conceive of real superlative characteristics, proving that those characteristics must exist in some being, and that is the thrust of the ontological argument. All right, have fun with that one, studying that one some more. All right, then there's one of my favorites, and that's the cosmological argument for the existence of God. And we'll camp out here for a moment. So the cosmos, the universe is here. It had to come from somewhere. Recall in Job 38 that God laid out the thrust of this argument there. He asked Job about the creation of the earth and the universe. Where did it come from? Who created it? Who laid the foundation of the earth? Who determined its measurements? Who stretched the line upon it? Who laid its cornerstone? So the universe exists. It demands a cause. It's usually the terminology we use today. So there has to be a reason, a cause for the universe. So cause and effect, this is fundamental to science. That's what science is all about. It's determining the effects of various causes and the causes of various effects. So if we want to be rational, then we have to accept the evidence, right? The law of rationality. And the evidence says that the law of cause and effect, or the law of causality, governs the universe in every case. And paraphrasing, it basically says if you've got an effect, there must logically be a cause. More precisely, every material effect must have an adequate antecedent or simultaneous cause. So the cause has to precede or come before the effect, or can occur at the same time as the effect. And it has to have the necessary potential, the necessary power to then cause the effect. So all natural effects must have causes. That's what we find based on the actual evidence. So we know that in nature, an effect has a cause. The fact that the planets exist, they're floating through space, they're spinning, these are effects. The existence of life, living beings, that's an effect. There must be an adequate cause for that. Someone had to cause these things to happen, and yet the naturalist, the atheist, has no explanation. The mere existence of the cosmos is proof of the existence of a supernatural being that caused it, something outside of the physical realm. All right, so how does the atheist deal with this? Well, you know, so what cause can the atheist point to for the existence of the universe without a God? Well, today the popular idea is, hey, the origin of the universe can be explained from this massive explosion-like event, from this extremely hot, tiny, dense ball billions of years ago. And of course, even if that were true, we always ask the question, all right, well, okay, let's just say that's right. Where did that little ball come from? So if you're a naturalist, if you're an atheist, you don't accept God, you've only got two options. Either it put itself here, it created itself, what we call spontaneous generation, and this is the dominant belief in cosmological circles today, or it is self-existent. That is, it didn't have to be created, it's always existed. All right, so let's think through the first option. Again, we want to look at the actual evidence and think through this. We don't want to have a blind faith. So this idea, you know, can be summarized this way. All right, so let's say you've got this invisible box that's around the whole universe. Okay, this is what we call a boundary layer in thermodynamics. It's big enough to hold the entire universe in it. All right, so if you believe the universe could spontaneously generate and just pop into existence on its own from nothing, then in a thermodynamic sense, you believe that this box was initially, before the Big Bang, completely empty. All right, so let's zoom inside of the box. And so the box is empty, and we're inside of this box here, and we're looking around. And the spontaneous generation model says no one put matter and energy here, it just put itself here. And so according to this model, you can stand around inside of this box and just stare into nothingness. And if you just give it enough time, all of a sudden, pop, something can just appear. And not only could something just pop into existence, but according to this version of the model, a little ball containing all of the mass and energy of the entire universe could just pop into existence. And then, so they say, the Big Bang process will get going. And eventually, given enough time, the universe will expand and life will spring into existence from non-life, gradually evolve over time, and then finally you accidentally show up in the universe. This is the dominant belief today. This is what the scientific community, essentially by consensus, has accepted. But there's a problem with this. There's many problems, but here's one of them. The first law of thermodynamics says this, summarized by this evolutionist, Willard Young: energy can be neither created nor destroyed, but can only be converted from one form to another. And this is also known as the law of conservation of matter and energy. What does that mean, practically speaking? I like to use the example of a log of wood burning. Have you ever thought about what happened to this log of wood after it burned? Where did it all go? Obviously, the pile of ash that's left, that alone couldn't account for all of it. So where did it go? Did it disappear from the universe? In other words, was it destroyed? Well, the first law of thermodynamics says that in any process that we've witnessed in the universe, whether it be wood burning or anything, matter and energy can change into other forms while it's burning, in this case like heat and light and ash, but the sum total amount of energy in the universe that was present before the wood burned has to equal the same amount of energy in the universe after the wood burned. So energy hasn't disappeared or been destroyed from the universe by burning the wood. It's just changed form. So more technical terminology. The first law says in a closed system, like a box that contains the whole universe, so there's no energy coming into the system or leaving the system, so no one is opening this box and putting matter energy into the box or taking it out. The amount of energy within the boundaries of that system are going to remain constant. So as this chart shows, the amount of energy present before any process like wood burning or the universe coming into existence, the amount of energy present before a process has to be the same as the amount of energy after the process. So if you start with nothing in the box before any such process, then that means there can be no energy after the process either. If you start with nothing in the universe before Big Bang, you're still not going to have any, again, based on the actual evidence. Things don't pop into existence. Nothing comes from nothing. There's no exception to this. The first law of thermodynamics has no known exceptions, so by implication, you would have a blind faith to believe this could happen. It's not based on actual evidence. It's unscientific. It goes against the laws of science to believe that matter and energy could create themselves. It violates all of the available evidence. So according to the first law of thermodynamics, the only way that matter and energy can appear inside of that box is if it was caused to appear there by something outside of the box. That's what you learn from science. So according to the scientific evidence, this first option is not possible if you want to be rational. Matter could not have spontaneously generated. So what about the second option? Could matter be eternal? People used to believe in this idea, and it's fallen on hard times. Fewer people believe in this now. And the reason is because the second law of thermodynamics. So this model would claim the universe has always been inside of that box. It didn't pop into existence. No one put it there. And it didn't pop into existence. It's always been there, either moving through space forever, expanding, or if you believe in the oscillating universe model, you believe the universe operates in a cycle where you've got a collapse and then a big bang and expansion. Collapse, a big bang, expansion, like a massive accordion going on and on, repeating forever. So either way, this model would say that matter is eternal. It's always been here. Well-known atheist, physicist, cosmologist, astrobiologist Paul Davies out at Arizona State University, writing in New Scientist, he said, the celebrated second law of thermodynamics says, roughly speaking, that in any change, the universe becomes a slightly more disorderly place. The entropy goes up, the information content goes down. This natural tendency towards disintegration and chaos is evident all around us. We see it everywhere. It's all around us. So what are the implications of that? In a technical sense, the second law of thermodynamics builds on the first law of thermodynamics, and it says that, okay, even though you've got the same amount of energy present after process as before, some of that energy has transformed into a less usable form of energy, and we call this entropy. And this is an irreversible process. We can't turn this around. It only goes in one direction. And so here's our chart again, and so notice this has to equal this before the energy before the process and after have to equal, but along the way you lose some of your usable energy. So in any kind of process in the universe is what we see. So practically speaking, what it means is that everything is gradually wearing out. The whole universe is decaying, it's deteriorating. We're running out of usable energy. So eventually we're going to be at a state of heat death. And just as Paul Davies said, we see this everywhere. You know, does a car get nicer over time? And wouldn't that be nice? You go out to the junkyard, and you get a clunker, and you just wait because eventually it's going to get nicer. It's going to turn into some kind of sweet ride. Wouldn't that be cool? That doesn't happen, right? We've got a law that says it's not going to happen. Wouldn't it be nice if your room got cleaner on its own without someone working on it? Kids, would you love that? That's very unfortunate. The second law prohibits that. A house's paint job, of course, isn't going to get nicer. It's going to cost you like 10 grand to get the thing repainted. It's just going to fade, chip. The house is going to fall down. All right, so eventually you're going to have a problem with this law, and we've all seen it in our life. So returning to our wood-burning example, so all the energy that was present before the wood burned is still present after it burned, according to the first law. But according to the second law of thermodynamics, much of it is now transformed into less usable forms of energy like heat. And when that heat dissipates, you're essentially left with a pile of ash, which, of course, isn't nearly as usable. And again, just like with the first law, the second law has never been broken. It has no exceptions. A prominent engineering thermal science textbook says this: to date, no experiment has been conducted that contradicts the second law, and this should be taken as sufficient proof of its validity. So there's no exceptions to this law. So what does this mean concerning the origins question? What are the implications? Well, it means the universe could not have always existed, and we still have usable energy. According to the second law of thermodynamics, if the universe is infinite in age, you should have no more usable energy left. Everything should be totally broken down. We should be in a state of heat death. And yet we have an abundant amount of usable energy in harmony with a younger universe, which is, of course, a prediction of the biblical creation model. And notice the biblical creation model, it's always in harmony with the evidence, in this case, the laws of thermodynamics. So the biblical creation model would predict that decay, a gradual loss of usable energy, are occurring, just as the second law states. So thousands of years ago, this was put in Scripture, this idea. The universe is not going to last forever. It's going to grow old and deteriorate. Hebrews 1, quoting from Psalm 102. So this goes back thousands of years. You, Lord, in the beginning laid the foundation of the earth, the heavens are the work of your hands. They will perish, but you remain. They will all grow old like a garment, like a cloak. You'll fold them up and they'll be changed, but you are the same and your years will not fail. All right, so again, we want to be rational. We don't want to have a blind faith here. And according to the actual observable evidence, the laws of science, specifically the first and second laws of thermodynamics, which do not have exceptions, spontaneous generation of matter couldn't have happened, and matter cannot be eternal. And those are the only two options for how atheistic evolutionary models could occur. So the evolutionary model is not possible, and by process of elimination, that leaves some form of supernaturalism, some form of creation. And on top of that, the creation model is, in fact, supported by both the first and second laws of thermodynamics. So if you stick with the actual evidence, rather than blindly accepting what naturalists are shoving down the throats of our young people, then the actual observable evidence points to God. And this is what we call the cosmological argument. So the universe is here. It couldn't create itself. It demands a cause. It requires a creator, an omniscient, omnipotent, omnipresent being outside the confines of the natural realm. All right, another classical argument, our sixth and last one for this session, is the teleological argument. This argument is especially of interest to engineering scientists. Atheistic philosopher and professor Paul Ricci said, "It's true that everything designed has a designer." And that statement summarizes the teleological argument. If there is design in the universe, there had to be, by implication, a designer. Atheists, like Ricci himself, generally admit that basic truth. But granted, they also generally refuse to admit the existence of design in the universe, but they concede that the presence of design would indicate there must be a designer, because you can't have a poem without there being a what? A poet. A painting requires a painter. This is kind of common sense, isn't it? What does a fingerprint require? A finger. Yeah, this is not rocket science here. So does the universe contain the characteristic of design? Well, in fact, there's an infinite number of examples from nature that clearly show intent, purpose, design. Things that engineers, terms that would be used by engineers to describe things that are being designed. And ironically, even again, notice what Shermer said about this. The examples are so infinite. The design inference comes naturally. The reason people think that a designer created the world is because it looks designed. We perceive nature to be intelligently designed based on our experience of human artifacts. In other words, it's based on actual evidence. We know some human artifacts are intelligently designed because we've observed them being made and we have vast experience with human artificers. So we just tap into our natural understanding, our observations, and now we just reason through to the implications of that when we see actual evidence of design in the realm around us. Remember what Shermer said here. Since the most common reason people give for why they believe in God is the good design of the world, intelligent design creationists are tapping into the intuitive understanding most people hold about life and the universe. So notice it's intuitive to people the fact that there is design in the universe. I'm a thermal scientist, so examples of thermal design in the universe are special interest to me. So one of the amazing thermal systems that God created is what we call the biothermal system. This is the system that oversees how your body responds to temperature fluctuations. So temperature changes in the environment and in our bodies. And your body does this through its use of this extremely complex thermoregulatory system. This is the system that helps to regulate your body temperature. So let's look at just a couple very brief details about this sophisticated system. The entire temperature system for your body, as you might expect, is controlled by the brain. And the processing center in the brain that controls the biothermal system is the hypothalamus. The hypothalamus is basically the thermostat for the body's air conditioning system. So it controls the thermoregulatory system. And so the body uses temperature sensors, like these would be like thermometers or thermocouples in engineering. These are called thermoreceptors, and these sensors are located throughout your body, and they read the temperature wherever they are. They're in your hypothalamus, they're in your skin, they're in the bladder, you even have them in your eyes. The thermoreceptors that are in your skin are your peripheral nerves, and they can detect changes in exterior temperature, so the temperature changes in the air. The thermoreceptors in the hypothalamus will actually detect changes in your blood temperature. And so from this temperature information, which already, does this sound like something that just happened by accident? Okay, so from this temperature information, the hypothalamus is able to adjust your body's thermoregulatory functions all over your body by using effector nerves. So these are kind of like power lines throughout your body that are used to communicate with various parts of the body to initiate various kinds of responses to temperature. Very sophisticated system that shows design and intent and purpose, not random accidents. So let's look at a specific example of what the hypothalamus does here. So this is a very small, often neglected, but amazing part of the temperature system. It's the bladder's detrusor muscle. You've got thermoreceptors in your bladder, sensors that are taking the temperature of the liquid in your bladder, and that sends that temperature data up to your hypothalamus using the power lines of communication in the nervous system, the effector nerves. And as the temperature of the bladder drops due to the cold, a bladder cooling reflex is triggered in the hypothalamus, and the message is sent down to the detrusor muscle on the bladder telling it to contract. So the detrusor contraction makes you feel the urge to eliminate that cold liquid from your body, which helps to keep your temperature regulated. All right, now again, stop and think here. Does that sound like something that just happened by accident? How could someone have the knowledge to even come up with an idea like that? So the muscle, the sensors, the nerves connecting the bladder all the way to the hypothalamus. Notice that had to be all planned out and intact and working from the beginning. So how helpful would it be to have an effector nerve that only went halfway between the brain and the bladder? No, it had to be all the way connected. And so this mechanism shows decisive planning and intention. These are things that cry out a mind. There had to be a mind behind it. An engineer had to design this. If you just stand back and look at this without any bias and just try to make an assessment, does it look like something that just was an accident, or does it look like there was an engineer that did this? Well, I think there's no way around it. This is design. The natural order is loaded with an infinite number of these kind of complexities and ingenuity. And I'm not alone in believing that. One area of engineering that is growing by leaps and bounds across the world is called biomimicry, as well as bio-inspired engineering. Biomimicry is where engineers are using nature as a blueprint, and they're just trying to copy it. And so the webpage for George Washington University Center for Biomimetics and Bio-Inspired Engineering says this: however, despite our seeming prowess in these component technologies, we find it hard to outperform nature in this arena. Nature's solutions are smarter, more energy efficient, agile, adaptable, fault tolerant, environmentally friendly, and multifunctional. In other words, there's awesome design. This is what the leading engineers are saying. Thus, there is much that we as engineers can learn from nature as we develop the next generation machines and technology. In other words, again, it's well engineered. The universe is well engineered. So much so that the top engineering minds are looking to nature for their designs. Now, many of these engineers would hardly be considered friendly to biblical creation, but this kind of mindset is becoming widespread in the engineering community. Engineers can't help but to stand in awe of the designs that are evident in nature. And so here's just a couple examples I'm going to give here. Engineers are more and more coming to the realization that insects function amazingly well, especially when you consider the fact that their brains carry less than 0.01% as many neurons as do human brains. Their ability to maneuver, especially in the air, is unequaled in engineering. We can't match this. And one of the insect features that engineers have relatively recently discovered is that many insects are equipped with a sophisticated engineering sensor that helps the insect to keep track of its orientation while it's flying, so that it'll stay upright while it's in the air. Ocelli are small eyes located on the heads of various kinds of insects. These are eyes in addition to the larger compound eyes that you can see more easily on insects, and usually think of those as their eyes, which are associated with insect vision. But you also then have these ocelli. And so engineers now believe these ocelli are horizon sensors. They're dedicated to that purpose, locating the horizon to help the insect keep track of its orientation in flight. So with these ocelli in mind, engineers are starting to try to mimic these horizon sensors in designing aerial vehicles. Engineers from Caltech and Australian National University in association with NASA have designed a biomorphic ocellus, mimicking the ocelli of dragonflies in order to try to achieve an improved flight stabilization system for aerial vehicles. Now, when engineers engage in this kind of design, they are acknowledging the awesomeness of the natural realm. They are conceding defeat in being able to figure this stuff out on their own. We've got to just copy it. Basically, plagiarism, if you don't give God the credit. The presence of design in the universe is being admitted, whether or not they mean to. It's not enough to just say, well, you know, evolution just accidentally, these things just popped up, you know, and were perfected over millions of years. No, Darwinian evolution doesn't have the ability to design horizon sensors on the head of a dragonfly, because evolution doesn't have a mind. A creator that is supreme over the engineering community is required. Here's another cool example. Have you ever put your hand out the window as you were driving down the interstate, you know, especially as a kid, and you feel the effect of the wind hitting your hand, and you tilt it at different angles, right? And you feel what the wind does to you. Sometimes maybe your hand will lift. Sometimes it might just throw it based on the angle of this tilt. And this is the same principle used in helicopter and wind turbine blades. And so you may have noticed that if you tilted it at certain angles, the wind would hit it in a funny way, and it would no longer lift your hand. It'll throw it or drop it. And this is a kind of stalling, what we term stalling on these kinds of machines that use blades. And this can be a major problem for devices that use these blades, but some scientists realized, wait a minute, humpback whales don't seem to have this problem. They can tilt their fins at aggressive angles as they're swimming without this stalling problem happening and without creating too much drag, which allows them to change their depth or their orientation in water quickly so that they can catch fast prey, right? Just about everything's going to be faster than these beasts. So engineers went to work trying to figure out what it is that's allowing for this kind of maneuvering. And what they found is amazing. Notice the fin of this whale. there's these bumps, funny little ridges called tubercles. You might just think that's an accident, you know, like he's got zits or on his fin or something. Here's another picture. Well, scientists at a company known as Whale Power, located in Toronto, Canada, figured out that these tubercles have something to do with the maneuverability of the whale, even though we still haven't totally figured out what's going on here yet. The company published work in 2004 showing that if you design blades with bumps like the tubercles on humpback whale fins, it'll push the stall angle on blades back by as much as 40%. The new blade design is reported by Popular Mechanics to increase the annual production of electrical power for wind farms by 20%. All right, so again, you have to stand back and ask, without any bias, can you deny that the universe is equipped with superior designs? You've got some kind of omniscient engineer that has designed an infinite number of sophisticated entities in the universe. And again, engineers still don't even totally understand why these zits of, you know, work the way that they do. So to claim that this feature just happened by accident without a purpose is an insult to engineers, really. You know, because engineers are now trying to rip off this design. You need a supreme engineer. It's logically demanded by the evidence. One final example of the amazing design of the universe that is inexplicable without a God. Famous atheist, theoretical physicist, cosmologist of Cambridge University, Stephen Hawking, who passed away a few weeks ago. He hosted a show on Discovery Channel in 2011 where he slammed theism and promoted atheism. In that show, here's what he said. The universe is a machine governed by principles or laws that can be understood by the human mind. I believe the discovery of these laws has been humankind's greatest achievement. But what's really important is that these physical laws, as well as being unchangeable, right? They don't have exceptions. They're also universal, right? They don't just apply here on the earth. We've got these laws that apply to they govern the whole universe. They apply not just to the flight of the ball, but to the motion of a planet and everything else in the universe. Unlike laws made by humans, the laws of nature cannot ever be broken. That's why they're so powerful. The laws of nature are fixed. So atheists acknowledge we've got these laws of science. They exist. And they're awesome already as they are, but they govern the entire universe. And so they stand in awe of these. They're so respected, these laws, that the atheists just don't want to just ignore them when they're trying to answer the big questions, like where did the universe come from? Could it create itself and not violate a law? This is always the kind of thing they're trying to work on. How did life come from non-life without violating the law of biogenesis? Well, it can't by definition. So they're constantly at work trying to figure out how questions like these can be answered without violating these powerful, undeniable laws. But the ironic thing is that even if the naturalists could find a way around the laws of nature to try to explain the universe in a natural way, they still have to answer the question of where the laws of nature came from in the first place. Why do they exist? Why do the laws of science even exist? Where did they come from? Who wrote them? Without a lawmaker, how could they even exist? Humanist Martin Gardner wrote a few years ago, imagine that physicists finally discover all the basic waves and their particles and all the basic laws and unite everything in one equation. We can then ask, why that equation and why are there quantum laws? There's no escape from the super ultimate questions. Why is there something rather than nothing? And why is the something structured the way that it is? So why does the universe operate the way that it does? Through regularities that we call laws that uphold the universe. What is the underlying power and direction that tells that power what to do? Why are there specific equations and specific numbers that describe how things work in the universe? See, equations, by definition, are not random. They indicate structure and design and intent and planning. They indicate a mind. These are not the kind of words you can use to describe the results of an explosion, which are words like chance, random chance processes and chaos. Those words describe evolutionary thinking. So someone had to write these laws for the universe to follow. Stephen Hawking believed that quantum mechanics could create a universe from nothing before the supposed Big Bang happened, which he also believed in. I go into this more in depth in that Science vs. Evolution book. But again, even if the Big Bang were true, Hawking himself still had to ask the important questions. Did God create the quantum laws that allowed the Big Bang to occur? In a nutshell, did we need a God to set it all up so that the Big Bang could bang? Now, his stubborn answer was no, but the problem is he could not provide answers to those questions, and he couldn't even attempt an explanation, and yet he still flat out rejected the idea of a God whose existence would actually give him a rational answer to this problem, which reveals that this is not about the evidence to the naturalistic community. This is about a bias against the idea of a supernatural being that would tell them what to do. How could a law of nature exist without a law writer? Paul Davies, who I've already quoted from, he responded to Hawking's contention about the universe creating itself, and he noted that Hawking asked that question, these questions about, you know, what about the laws of science? Where do they come from? So he calls him on that and notes, though, that Hawking mentioned that and then stepped away from it without giving an explanation to it. And so notice what he said. He said, you need to know where those laws come from, and that's where the mystery lies, the laws. They have no explanation for this. They don't have any answer because you can't have a law without a law writer. All right, so if you want to believe that a natural law could write itself into existence, you're not doing that based on evidence. What does that make you? Irrational, based on the law of rationality. By definition, you have to have a blind faith to believe that. You know, isn't it ironic that it's the naturalists that point the finger at theists and say, you guys have a blind faith, we don't. No. Okay, now granted, there are a lot of theists out there with a blind faith. True biblical religion is not blind. We can follow the evidence. It's going to point to God. They must have a blind faith in several fundamental tenets of the naturalistic model in order to be a naturalist. The existence of the laws of science are proof that God exists and that naturalistic evolution is inadequate in its attempt to harmonize with the evidence. There is design that demands a designer. That is the teleological argument. You know, so the naturalistic model has no reasonable explanation for several critical points in the universe, but the creation model, again, perfectly in harmony with the evidence. While the atheistic model can't explain the origin of the laws of science, guess which model can? Long before the laws of thermodynamics were formally articulated in the 1850s, long before the law of biogenesis was formally proven by Pasteur 1864, the laws of science had already been written. Now, you remember in the last few chapters of the book of Job, God makes this speech to Job, humbling him with the knowledge that Job is not in a position to be demanding answers from God. He's not in a position to even understand what all is going on in the universe. He knows essentially nothing compared to God, who knows everything and created everything in the universe. And remember, he asks a series of humbling questions, and two of those might just pass by without you noticing. Job 38:33, do you know the ordinances or the laws of the heavens, and can you set their dominion or their rule over the earth? These are rhetorical questions. The obvious answer was, no, sir, right? I don't even know what you're talking about, right? I mean, that's what Job would be having to say. Not only, it's like what Hawking was trying to, you know, figure out. We've got these laws, and they're governing the entire universe with this invisible energy. We can't even detect it. How does this happen? Implied in these questions is the fact that the laws of science were written by God. So, of course, you would expect them to be in harmony with the biblical creation model. But atheism can't even give an explanation for their existence. If you follow the evidence, there's got to be a law writer. We got over 7 billion people on the earth, and if you were to break it up into all the different kind of religions out there, 1.3 billion Islam, which is rising rapidly in America, 1 billion Hindus, 6% of the world is Buddhist. You've got your non-religious, 1 billion people, quite a bit, include your atheists and infidels and irreligious. Still the highest numerically religion would be Christianity. Half of those are Catholic. So 1 billion of them or so are Catholic. All right, so question, are we ready to defend the truth on the wide array of false ideas that are all around us here in America and growing quickly? You know, we don't live in the same world here in America even that was the case even 50 years ago. You know, by and large, America was Christian in its thinking. That's not what we have today. But according to 1 Peter 3:15, God expects all Christians to be apologists. Right? That word defense. You know, people always ask us at AP, apologetics. I really disagree with the title of your organization. You guys have nothing to apologize for. Right? That's not what apologetics is, right? Apologetics comes from the Greek word apologia, which means defense. It's right here in 1 Peter 3:15. Always be ready to give an apologia. We're all supposed to be apologists. We're supposed to be ready to defend the truth to anyone, anywhere, anytime. And then we're warned, you know, like in Ezekiel 3, hey, if you don't do it, when I say to the wicked, you shall surely die, and you give him no warning, nor speak to warn the wicked from his wicked way to save his life, okay, yeah, he's going to die, but his blood I'll require at your hand. Yet if you warn the wicked and he does not turn from his wickedness, nor from his wicked way, he shall die in his iniquity, but you have delivered your soul. You know, so we're expected to be ready to deal with the kind of attacks that are being made on Christianity by atheists and warn people about sin and the dangers of ignoring the truth. Evolution is one of those tools, but we got all kinds of stuff we're dealing with today. What about the inspiration and integrity of the Bible? That's being challenged. Has the Bible been corrupted in its transmission? How do we deal with Islam? What about issues like stem cell research and abortion and capital punishment and euthanasia and transgenderism and environmentalism and animal rights and global warming? Does God have anything to say about these things? Homosexuality. You know, what is the truth on all these things? And how do we answer people that want to know God's view on these kind of questions? And so God expects us to be prepared to speak the truth in this day and age, no matter what that topic may be. And notice the Lord's people are being challenged in unique ways today that perhaps the church has not been challenged in those ways in the 2,000 years that it has existed. And perhaps most of us are just really not up to the challenge. We're not really ready to deal with the argument. So if you're unaware of what Apologetics Press is, it is an organization whose goal from the very beginning has been to fill this need. Okay, so it's the idea that as Christians, we've got a lot going on. We don't have time to do the research necessary to be prepared to deal with all this stuff. Somebody's got to do it. And so Apologetics Press was begun, and therefore it was funded by individuals and congregations, and we still are, to try to do what we do, to get the answers, package it in a way where you need it, so that you can take it and use, not just for yourself and your children, but also to prepare yourself to defend the truth on all kinds of issues that the church has to be ready to deal with today. So I encourage you to take some time to look at the materials that I brought this week and this weekend and set up back there. There are apologetics-related materials for adults and teens and kids and even infants, as well as lots of free materials on our website. So bottom line, let's make sure that we're ready to give a defense and that we're helping others to that end as well. Throughout the rest of the sessions this weekend, I'll try to take a little bit of time at the end of each session to tell you about a few of the products each time that I have back there, because there's a lot of stuff back there. It's hard to know what it's for. What's its purpose? Why do I need this book versus this one? But again, keep in mind the purpose of that material is to get you what you need to defend the truth, right? That's the important thing here, to make sure that we're being good Christian apologists. All right, I thank you for your attention, and we'll be ready for a break here in a moment.